let me start out with just a little bit of background on the Rainbow on the Mountaintop here at Holden, and then what we want to do is to just ask for some brief introductory comments from some people in the room who've had, continuing, interesting and challenging and I think probably very exciting experiences in working in multicultural contexts. And then we want to ask everybody here to share what you can in the way of success stories, in the way of excitement that you've experienced, that you've encountered in your own life when working in multicultural kinds of contexts. Holden, as you all, I think even those of you who are here for the first time, see, Holden is a fairly unique place. It's stuck out in a corner of the United States, which is incredibly remote, which is incredibly difficult to get to.
Something's happening in our room. We're getting you on the speakers.
Emo?
Yeah, ask.
Hello, Emo. Emo, we're going into the wrong room. Let's let them work. Let's let them work.
Get a good shot next door. Oh, yeah, Emo.
Well, yeah, I was saying what a strange place Holden was, and here we have it. We're probably being piped into the shower someplace. Disturbing people. It is a unique place. It's stuck off in the corner here. It's in this spectacular natural setting. It has incredible advantages as a retreat place, as a place for people to come and renew themselves, to think about their own relationship to God's incredible creation. One of its downsides is that in terms of both location and to some degree in terms of heritage, it has been predominantly white, right? It's no surprise to anybody. Lutheranism is predominantly white, and though lots of people who come to Holden are not Lutherans, that is a major part of the constituency, and that has determined over the years the paleness of Holden. Nonetheless, from its very beginnings, when Wes Priebe first signed the letter with the mining company to take this over for the Lutheran Church, the leadership of the village has been committed to a vision that was that was multicultural, that went as far as the globe can take us in terms of the peoples of God, and has in various ways through the last 30 years attempted to be a servant in God's multicultural creation. Rainbow on the Mountaintop is simply the current part of the current effort of Holden to open up the world in all of its color. There's a nice shirt for talking about color, Kent. Good morning. That's right. Holden's board and leadership, including the then director Elmer Witt and the current director Scott Hasserud, and the interim director over the last winter, Paul Bowe, have all been committed to making renewed and extra efforts at making Holden a place where multicultural celebration is assumed on a year-round basis. These 10 days, 10 to 12 days, Rainbow on the Mountaintop, is simply one small part of a larger vision for Holden, a vision that this is a place where God's natural creation and all of God's people can come together, and it's a safe place. It's a place where we can struggle together with differences, and it's a place where we can grow together as we find our common humanness and our common kind of spirit here. That's the vision for Holden. And Rainbow, then, these 10 days, these 12 days of Rainbow on the Mountaintop is simply a step toward that. It's a sort of conscious step that Holden, with some limited resources, is trying to say to as wide an audience as possible, come on, let's use this beautiful corner of God's creation as a place to celebrate all of our cultures, to talk about our differences, and to celebrate those as well, and to think about the ways in which we're all one. So Rainbow on the Mountaintop is not the end of anything. It's the beginning, and it's a continuation of a lot of stuff that Holden has been committed to over the years. It seems to, I think, the leadership of the village that as Christian peoples in an increasingly global kind of context, where all of us are part increasingly not only of Holden Village, but of the global village, that it is in some ways heretical not to work very hard at creating a multicultural context in reality. In some ways it goes against, in many ways it goes against the kind of vision that we get as Christians, it seems to me, of a wholeness of God's creation. And we're more and more aware of that every day, it seems to me. Holden's doing this, it seems to me, too. Let me just say, by way of a little further introduction, it seems to me, as somebody who works in race relations and multicultural realities daily, Holden is doing this in a countercultural moment. That is, I don't think the rest of the United States is very serious about race relations at this moment in its history. I've just done a few sessions this past week that I titled After the National Nap, when sort of thinking about the last decade or 15 years, at least in terms of social issues and multicultural reality and race relations and economic progress, that in lots of ways we've been asleep as a nation for the last 10 to 15 years. That there isn't that kind of excitement about a social experiment anymore in America. That it may be, in fact, we're waking up from the national nap, and I hope we're waking up from the national nap, but that there's the possibility to recreate some of the inventiveness that really is part also of the American experience. If it's true that we're waking up, Holden wants to be part of that. But Holden also, I think, wants to recognize that the reality that we're facing at this moment is that, in fact, race relations are not improving, that they're getting worse, that the gap between wealthy and poor is widening, that we see all over signs of a kind of rejuvenated racism. I think about the English-only kind of campaigns that we're seeing all over the place, you know, often led by people whose own parents spoke something besides English, right? But the kind of xenophobia and chauvinism, I think, that defines a lot of a fearful white America at this point is part of what we have to deal with. That's part of the reality. And overcoming that fear, for all of us who are white, it seems to me, is a major challenge. One of the ways that I overcome my fear about changing is to constantly re-experience the joy of multicultural living. I experienced a lot of that last night in our service. And we experienced that, I think, in so many ways, living in a multicultural city like Chicago and working across cultures in various ways. It seems to me that we get rid of our fear, we get rid of our anxiety, we get rid of our sort of trepidation about moving forward and imagining. If we can get into a receptive mode that is open to the experiences and the modes of expressions of other people, and that celebrates God's diversity. So I think what we want to do this morning is to share some stories about that, about ways in which our experience has been, our own experience has been enriched by our work situations, our parish situations, our living situations, a variety of settings in which we have learned from other cultures, where we've seen cross-cultural, multicultural work come to fruition in some way, where the richness that's possible has been actualized in our own lives. So I want to stop there and ask a couple of people to kick off that discussion about success stories in multicultural living. I've asked a couple people to just think about that ahead of time. One of the obvious stories we've got right in front of us here. We've got this marvelous crew from St. Teresa's in Seattle. And although I've never been to St. Teresa's, when I am in Seattle occasionally, I ask around where the action is. And everybody always mentions St. Teresa's as one of the places where the action is, where some stuff is going on that's awfully interesting and creative. So I thought one of the ways for us to get into this would be to ask a couple of the people from St. Teresa's to tell us a little bit about a multicultural parish that seems bucking all of the tides to be working and to be a place where people can struggle and celebrate together. So let me turn it over to somebody from St. Teresa's. Who's going to? Okay.
My name is Almeda Jones, and I have been I would say a member of St. Teresa Parish for almost 27 years. St. Teresa has always, not always, been diverse as it is right now. It's a very, right now it's a very diverse parish. And when I say diverse, we have many cultures in our parish. And I think most of us feel like one big family in that parish because everyone cares about everyone in that parish. But as I said, it hasn't always been like that. When I first came there, I would say 27 years ago, and my husband and I first moved into the Madrona neighborhood, it was predominantly white. There were a few black families that had been upstanding in the parish for quite a few years. And of course, you know, they were always very well accepted. When we first entered our children in school there, we had a few problems. Not a whole lot, because the neighborhood that we had moved from had been predominantly white, and we were the only black family in that neighborhood for a long time. And my kids, for 5 years, they kept saying, we'll be glad when we move out of this neighborhood and move into a neighborhood where, you know, we can go to school and feel comfortable. So finally we did, 5 years later, and we moved into St. Teresa's Parish. Getting our kids into school was a little bit of a hassle, but when we did get them into school, they felt that they were a little bit more comfortable because there were other black kids in school. There were other minority kids in school there, but not as many as probably we had hoped for. But anyway, our life started settling down there, and we became pretty comfortable in it. But it was a thing where we were going to church every Sunday, but we were not making a lot of friends. It was just like, you know, you go to socials and things. People would acknowledge you, but it was not a thing. You didn't belong to the group, really. And so it was, I would say, several years before we really felt comfortable in that parish. About, I would say, 13 years ago, we got a priest in that parish who looked at things a lot different, and he started thinking that he should turn our parish around and start doing some different things with it. So he not only started working with what we might say, we had an awful lot of wealthy people in our parish at that time. He started thinking he should not only start working with them, but he should start working with some of the other people that were in the parish. Some of those were just as important as the people that had been supporting the parish all these years. That meant going out and visiting people in their homes individually. So he did this, and our home was one of the ones. And he started getting us involved in all kinds of things, and we began to meet people. We began to be a little bit more out, you know, going in the parish and getting involved in things a little bit more because our kids were in school. And our kids, likewise, they started getting to feel like they belonged. They really belonged to the neighborhood now. One of the things that he got me involved in, and I'm really glad now, was first of all, he got my husband to go to a Crisillo weekend. And after that, then he got me to go. And of course, I thought it was one of the most beautiful things that I had ever attended. My daughter, who at that time was married, she also went with me. And she and I both experienced the same thing together. So we thought, hey, you know, if we can experience something like this together, you know, in a group like we did at Crisillo, you know, we can experience a lot more in our parish. Well,
say a word about what Crisillo is.
Well, Crisillo, I don't know whether any of you know anything about it, but this is a weekend that you go and experience you yourself with Christ. You have a walk with Christ. And when I say it's sort of like a renewal of your whole life with Christ. And I felt like I thought I knew Christ, but during that weekend, I felt like I really had found my life with Christ then. And I felt like when I came from there, I wanted to do more about it. So what I did was, Father had kept talking to me about getting into this choir that we had. You know, first of all, the men had started a choir with Kent when they came out of this Crisillo weekend. And of course, they sang for about a year. And of course, the women started getting jealous, and they started. And it was a few months before I decided to join, but I got enough nerve to join after he kept after me for so long. And when I joined, At first, I didn't know how much it was going to do for me. But after I had been in that choir for about a year, and I had become so close to all the choir members and to Kent, who has been our choir director for about 15 years, right?
Yes. Kent,
I started experiencing things I had never experienced before. As you know, we sing every Sunday for Mass, but we also go out into the community and reach out to other churches in the community, not just the Catholic Church, but we reach out to the Lutheran Church, which we have been to many Lutheran churches. We reach out to the Baptist, the Methodist, any church that asks us, you know, to come out and perform for them or do a function with them. We go to
Aunt St. Therese, and the teacher makes a special effort to get children from all as many nationalities as she possibly can find. This way the children develop a friendship and a respect for one another that they will carry, not just until they're 12 years old, but they'll carry it through life, you know. And this has worked real good for the children.
We might mention that this is a, she's a black teacher, mm-hmm. and she works with all kinds of children, but she makes no differences in who they are.
Mm-hmm. Let's see, I have so many thoughts going through my mind. I don't know where to begin, because I have a lot of different experiences. I come from, or I'm part of, an interracial family, and a lot of times when I'm in groups that are all white, they assume certain things about me that are not accurate, and a lot of times I'll get privy to prejudicial comments or pieces of information that the person, if they knew my background, would not likely share with me, and it's been an interesting experience to sort of pick up on the latent prejudices that are still present in our society. I've been with the choir since it began. And I was a person who went through Catholic schools, first year of college, I mean the whole bit, the whole traditional Catholic background. When I got out, I said, I'm never going to do this to my kid. And I sort of drifted away from the church. I'm sure a lot of people went through this experience that I don't want anything to do with this anymore. And really, when I came back, moved into the neighborhood in the 70s and went to the church, Canada at that time had a youth choir. And the music actually literally brought me back to church. And when he started the choir here, I was one of the first ones that came up and said, I want to be a part of this. But the other thing that's been a real gift for me is I had the opportunity to be the director of a youth program that was really 99% minority. And I had been very much part of the black community and felt very comfortable in there and was, I think, over the years have established credibility, et cetera, et cetera. That was my community, so to speak. But in the program, we had a large number of Southeast Asian students who were refugees. And one of the things that we had to work very hard on were the relationships between the black students in the program, which were about 50%, and the Asian students in the program, because there were some real prejudices and some real lacks of knowledge about each other. And traditionally in other programs, it had real problems with the two groups interacting, and they didn't, and there were conflicts. And we put into our program an actual, I don't want to say course or class, but we actually had part of personal development, working with those students to understand about each other and why there were differences, and to respect those differences. And one of, I think, the proudest things in my life was being able to work with that group, and that was for about a 5-year period, to really break down those barriers. And it was really rewarding to see the two groups interacting as friends. When we had, at the end of each summer, we had a summer program with the students, and they had to vote on the students that they thought were the ones that represented best the values in the Upward Bound program. And invariably, the Asian students would get in, and this was by a group that was predominantly not Asian. So we had really, I think, succeeded in breaking down those barriers. But I feel my life has been so enriched by being able to be part of and feel part of a different culture.
Thank you. Guillermo, do you have any reflections as you listen to this conversation from
from a Salvadoran perspective?
Yes, I have many reflections, but my language is not so well.
Well,
as it's present, but I think I was thinking in our own work with the music. I think the music is a very good instrument to do a multicultural work. And our experience has been in the same way. For example, I'm thinking now that, for example, the songs of the folk Salvadorian mass, now many people from Latin America are singing. And I didn't think that these songs can reach so far of my country and sing it in another situation, another culture, for example, in Mexico or in Colombia or Brazil, different kind of people with other cultures, they are singing the same songs, and these songs tell to them something. And for example, last year I had the experience that a number of choirs from Sweden, seven or eight choirs from Sweden get together to sing in Swedish the Salvadorian mass.
Oh, really?
I didn't know how they did that change of translation. But they sent it to me, the recording tape. Because they wanted that I came to Sweden, but I couldn't come. And afterwards, they sent the recording tape of the service where they did the Salvadorian Mass in a very important cathedral, I think, from Uppsala. And I feel the same spirit, you know, in our communities. And I wrote them afterwards, tell them that I was surprised and I was very happy because I felt the same spirit in the songs. So I think the music is very, very good instruments to do this multicultural work.
Absolutely, yeah.
Guillermo, is the name of the group Jaeger?
Yeah, I know them.
Is it the same group?
Some of the people.
Oh.
Because there are no more theater group.
There isn't.
No, they now have another group named Gondwana. Gondwana is a word from South Africa. Uh-huh. The director of theater was in South Africa for 2 years working there, and after he came back to Sweden, and with a friend from South Africa, and they found a new group. With South African songs, and yes. They, for example, Freedom is Coming, they have another tapes, and they did a very, very important work in Sweden with the songs, telling the situation in South Africa,
And that's
through the songs.
That's come here.
Yes.
Those songs are favorites of Holden's, and Holden, in fact, has a group that sings those songs
and
all the time.
This group now is going to be in Nicaragua and in El Salvador in November.
Really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. They want to do a work, the same work that they did in South Africa. They want to go to Central America to hear songs from Central America, and afterwards they are going to take it back to Sweden and do us the same kind of work, telling about the situation in Central America through the songs.
Interesting. Music really is the way in which the barriers get broken down. Your English, by the way, is terrific.
Yeah.
Other comments? What's working? Kent, do you want to jump in? Or?
Oh, I have.
Okay.
Thanks, Kent. I work in theater, and as well as in the choir, which has been an incredibly enriching experience for me. By and large, the theater with which I've been fortunate to work is a theater which is, their mission is to create on the stage what is in the city of Seattle as we walk down the street. So that, in fact, the artistic director, who is Hispanic, his point of view is that is the only non-ethnic theater in the city, because the other theaters are predominantly white.
Mm-hmm.
And his theater has a richness of a lot of different cultures. And that has been an incredible experience, to be so involved with a theater company whose message and whose mission is to reflect the society as it really exists. One of the plays that I was involved with as an actor, that was the most marvelous, I mean, I thought when I went into the theater that the most marvelous experience for me would be playing Blanche in Streetcar Named Desire, which I did, you know, and that was primo. I mean, that was a fabulous experience. Then I became involved in a play about South African apartheid, written by a black South African exile who also played one of the roles in the play. And I was fortunate to be in the play because my daughter was in the play, and they then, in remounting the production, cast me as her mother. It was, to be involved in that play, partly was a fabulous experience because of the play and because of the richness of the playwright working with us, and the piece itself is a beautifully written piece that says its message in very wonderful human terms that allow us to laugh and be moved at the same time. But the other part to that experience that was the most enriching for me was that it was, for the first time, the most successful production I've ever seen, even back east, where there was a more of a cultural diversity in the theater-going population. There were probably 50% of a black audience and 50% of a white audience attending Homeland. And it was an incredible experience to be a part of the audience, which I was for the first production mounting. And I went 6 times because to be in this audience of such cultural diversity, and we all responded in different ways, and yet as the same, and really we did, I felt, that the barriers were broken down. And that is, for me, the main disappointment many times in theater is the barriers are not broken down, and yet I think that we go to theater because we want the barriers to be broken down. Hmm. I think we want to respond to the person next to us and get to know them and feel one with them, and yet many times we can't. We're still in a little box and it's too hard to break out. When we break out for a few minutes and then we come back again. In Homeland, I didn't feel that happened. I felt that we all experienced together.
Hmm.
And then to be on stage and to have this incredible energy coming from the audience was marvelous. The interesting thing is that was, I don't know, maybe 4 years ago now? So, and some of my friends at the choir came to see the play.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter still experiences going on the bus, and she was young then, now she's a young woman. She still experiences going on the bus and having people say, "You were in that play about South Africa."
Mm-hmm.
And I, in my 20 years of theater, have never had that kind of long-term memory from an audience. So that, to me, is where I would like theater to go. Music seems to have an easier time, for some reason, of doing that. And I think for theater, my own personal answer for theater is that we not only need to reflect society on stage, we also need to get into totally non-traditional casting.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And even in the theater in the world, yeah, that is not happening. Mm-hmm. Traditional casting.
Mm-hmm. Others, how about parish life? Are there stories from parish life that either incorporate the arts or through other ways have worked and broken down? Jerry?
I had a really good experience last year up here at Rainbow on the Mountaintop. Back in the late 60s, I was on a pastoral staff of a very traditional Lutheran congregation on the east side of Detroit, Emmanuel Lutheran Church, that was located just across the street from the park in which the National Guard was bivouacked in 1967, sat right next to the largest public housing project. And the pastor of the church was also the chair of the Board of World Missions of the LCA, and he brought documents from the Marinoles in. And the life of the congregation was receptive and strong enough to begin looking at who are the groups in the community with whom we share common interests and goals. And that led to some work starting with the Black Panthers, who were interested in hot breakfast, and the welfare mothers, who were interested in Head Start programs, and the New Detroit Coalition that was interested in relationships between the police and the community, and led to a retreat in which policemen came out of their squad cars and leaders in the neighborhood came out, went on retreat together. And that ties into last summer, because the one of the music directors for Rainbow was James Harris. I don't remember if you remember him, Kent. He was here from Detroit. He's a principal Black man, principal of the largest high school in Detroit. And lo and behold, Emmanuel Lutheran Church was the community within which the Detroit Folk Mass had its birth, in a Black idiom of music. And here it was coming out of this congregation that 20 years ago suffered a lot of pain, but found ways to celebrate a lot of joy, and now the community is contributing to the larger life of the mm-hmm. church, again through music and liturgy.
Mm-hmm. Great. You sort of think about even Detroit, right?
Yeah, right, even Detroit.
Yeah.
This may be too soon to talk about this, but before you do, I'd like some input into this. I live in a community in Minneapolis.
Can you speak up? We can't hear you.
Oh, a little bit louder. I live in a community of Minneapolis, predominantly white, Scandinavian. I belong to a Scandinavian Lutheran church. I, sadly to say, do not know a minority person. And I've asked this question before in my life, and I guess I wasn't ready for the answer. But I don't know. What do I do?
Yeah. We just say that. I mean, you're not alone, right? I mean, there.
No,
all of the. If you look at the numbers, the
people in my community probably won't agree with me.
In fact, residential life has gotten more segregated over the last 15 years rather than less. We're growing apart rather than together. It's a real question.
I've been searching for the past year, and I think. Really searching for something in my life, and I think perhaps this is what I'm looking for. Is mm-hmm. I'm bored with the Norwegians and the Lutherans. I attend Catholic churches, and the eyebrows are raised in my community. So I just don't know where to go.
Sure.
To
well, let's throw that one around a little bit. Kent?
I was waiting for that question. Just to preface that, I was hired right out of college, this is so incredible, I can't even believe it happened, but to be the editor of a community newspaper in Ballard in Seattle, which is the Scandinavian stronghold. And there was a young Jewish entrepreneur, strange enough, in Ballard, who had started up a second newspaper weekly. And I had been real active on the University of Washington daily and very visible. I had a column in the paper, so my picture was right there every day, giving advice to all these hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, who did I think I was? But I did it. So they liked my writing and had never met me, and I had followed my column for a long time. And so he said, I want this guy to be the editor. So I got this call, and I thought, Ballard? I don't want to go to Ballard. I may never get out of there. No, I'm serious. You know, they burned crosses on Ballard High School's lawn in the 60s. Yes. Fact. I did not want to go to Ballard. I mean, it's like all white, all Scandinavian, which is wonderful. But I took the chance. I thought, well, let's go see what this is all about. I took the job, and to my amazement, I fell in love with Ballard and the people. Of course, I was kind of an anomaly, walking around getting stories from around the community and whatnot. But I think I needed that exposure, and I think the people needed that exposure. They needed to see someone like me participating in the community in a positive way. And I think I did an excellent job, made many friends, did many feature stories. I know more Scandinavian history, more Ballard history, ate more lutefisk than probably any black person I know. So that's the answer. I made a decision to go to Ballard with all my reservations of being not accepted, with no security of others like me around me. I had to go out in the field alone. I had to knock on Mrs. So-and-so's door and say, I was in here because you've got the biggest pumpkin this year. So we laugh. That's what community newspapers print. So after they got the startled moment was over with, they'd say, "Well, let's go out and look at it." And so I would write a wonderful story, and then next thing I know, there's a bunch of krumkaka on my desk the next day. So after a while, an interchange does happen. That's what you have to do. You have to leave the safe haven of your neighborhood, of your church, community, if you really want to experience what the multicultural life is. You have to go to where it is. You have to make a special commitment to yourself, no matter what your family says, your neighbors, all the rest of them, they'll think you're crazy. You've got to do that. You've got to, first of all, recognize that it's an important thing to do for your own individual enrichment, and then you can impart that new experience to those around you.
Did this do anything to your image amongst your own people?
Well, at that point, I was not concerned about that.
Okay.
Because what was important for me was to see, okay, I'm going to see if I can survive in this neighborhood. I rode the bus in every day. You have to make this. You just don't pass through Ballard. You have to go to Ballard willfully. And I lived in the very, very diverse university district, which everything is there, you know, of every kind, shape, color, size, whatever. And that's the excitement that I enjoy, which was completely different from very residential, very clean, very orderly, a neighborhood experience in Ballard. But that was an experience that I had not had, and which I found to be a very rich one. And I, as a result, have grown just from working there around the folks who live there. I know lots of Ballard history. We met is there a king of Sweden?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was there, I met him? Okay, I mean, how many of you all have met him? Just walks around like everybody, we chatted and had a great time. That's kind of a reverse. I made the decision. I could have said, no, I'm not interested. I'd rather do something that I know to be safe. It's risk. You've got to take a risk. You really do. Yeah, I had my own innate, and confess, we all have our own innate prejudices about folks we don't know about. We don't know about them. I didn't know anything. Only thing I had in my mind was, they eat a lot of fish, and they burnt this damn cross on the high school lawn, which I'm still mad about, in the 60s. On the Ballard High School lawn, because I think there were two black kids that were attending at that time. So I was angry still, but my search for a new experience and realizing that, well, I need to know what these people are about, really. And they need to know what I'm about in that small way. So I took that risk to go over there, got hired, and had a beautiful experience for 2 years working and living with the folks there every single day, work day. There are people that are friends of mine now who are white who also say the same thing. Well, the kids are gone and the lawn's cut and the bills are paid and the house is wonderful and the neighborhood's gorgeous and my friends are wealthy and the church is wonderful and it's paid for. Now what? Is it a life of the VCR and watching the soap operas and going to another boring bridge meeting with the same boring friends to talk about redecorating again? I mean, how meaningful can that be? And there are, well, I mean, just as another extreme story, wealthy people who leave their safe havens and they do go volunteer. They make a special effort to go into a setting, which could be anything. Working with a Native American a school, for example, teaching. The list could go on and on. If you're creative, you will start seeking small ways to go out. Don't be content with saying, well, I understand, you know, I see what's on television, and, you know, and I read the papers. That's just the tip of the iceberg. If you're really going to be true to yourself and say, well, I really do want to take this wonderful vision that is made manifest here in Holden and take it back to where I live and make it real. I often wondered, every time I come here, we do all the music and people come up and say, oh, the music was great. It really moved me. It really spoke to me. I really like it. And then I wonder, well, so what do you do about it when you leave here? You just go back to the safe haven and you're just the Lutheran from Minnesota again, and that's it until next year, and then it's a multicultural, you know, that doesn't work. That will not work. I constantly seek out. That's why I never would have been happy at St. Therese just going to Mass every week and singing for the folks and then leaving and that's it. Personally, I think my job is to go out. And luckily, I've got a beautiful group of choir people who love me and trust me enough to say, okay, I think that's a good plan, to go out among the folk in this world as Christ did do actively. He could have sat in the temple and waited for the folks to come to him. But not once did that happen. He went forth. He took the risks. He walked on the road. And that's, in our small way, what we do. We go into every community. Large, small, rich, poor. We sing on the streets. We've sung in festivals. We've sung in bars. We've sung in, we have. We sing in wealthy churches where they look at us like, my God, who are all these people? And what's all this loud music? And they're bringing drums in here. Oh, no, you know. We have to take that risk. And invariably, there is some person that will come up tearfully and say, wow, I wish you all were here every week. That's the reward. That one person, that's the reward. When the music, as Guillermo said, that's the tool. It's not my own brilliance, none of that. I was talking to a gentleman here last night about this very thing. It's the gift of the music, and my job, I have interpreted, is to facilitate. Nothing more. Just to facilitate, just to get it out. It comes through me, the whole vessel process. And I feel excited constantly about that miracle, that I can be used in an active way. Get out there and do this music. Communicate with people, talk, let them see you physically. Touch them, move with them, learn from them, listen to them. Listen to what others have to say. It's not just us with the message, us with the music. Believe me, it is really reciprocal. I have learned so much. Just coming to Holden and listening to others, to where they are. And I hear folks that say what you say all the time. What do I do? What do I do? Well, you think about it. You ask yourself really what you can do. Explore what your environment is. Not just within the 5-mile radius. You have to go beyond that, even if it's just once a month to do some active thing in another complete setting. Forget about what your friends say. The next thing they'll know, you know, they'll be asking you, can we come with you? Can we be part of this new excitement? Find something to do. If I were not a musician, I often wonder, how could I still do the same thing if it were not music? And I dare say, necessity being the mother of invention, we could come up with ways to communicate with one another and be meaningful.
Part of what I would do, Uncle.
I think your point is very good in terms of finding points of common interest where people can feel at home. I was raised in what a friend of mine calls a Norwegian ghetto of rural Iowa, where I didn't really meet anybody from any other kind of a culture until I was away from home. And I moved to Central Texas, which is a different culture in itself, and to Chicago, where there are pockets with lots of different kinds of interests. But in what I have seen, I think the choir that you have, the music interest, works very well within our church at home. The choir is a subgroup that's in and of itself. If you're a musician and join the choir, you can integrate it into that group within our church very quickly because you have that common interest. I've seen it work with a model railroad club. People of a lot of different cultures that were interested in model railroads came together and got to know each other first because they talked about the trains, and it expanded out from there. And so if you can find, I think a lot of the ethnic splits we have are because we came from Norway or Vietnam or Japan, and we go where we feel comfortable because those people have a common background. We started from there when we came to this country, but now as we live here, my son in the high school he's in, one of his best friends is Chinese, one is from Brazil. There's a mixture there that they came out of a neighborhood where they did things together. But there are a lot of different things that you can find common interest with people if you look a little bit to make that opportunity of doing something together that you're comfortable with. You're not completely outside your realm. And I think we have a tape of Mary Schramm talking about gifts of the Spirit. And when they started a church in Washington, D.C., they asked the members of this new church that had a half a dozen people, what do you like to do? And one of the guys said, I like to make model airplanes. And when they went out and canvassed the neighborhood, they found a single mother who had a young son who wanted to build model airplanes, and she knew nothing about it. And ended up, this guy had half a dozen young boys in his home teaching them to build model airplanes, and that became a core group of families that joined that church, starting from model airplanes. So there are places you can make connections that just get you away from the ethnic or cultural interests that you, or prejudices that you come into the area with.
I might make a suggestion to this lady also. You know, she wants to really get to know something about another culture or whatever. Is the fact they have an exchange program of students that like to come to this country to have somebody, you know, sponsor them or help them to have somewhere to live. That might be something you might look into that might be helpful to you.
Mm-hmm. Other quick comments.
If you've ever sold Amway. No, if you have to take a plunge, you have to dare to ask a stranger, dare to talk to strangers about things if you want to make a sale. So this is probably one of the things that she's going to have to do, and she can't care about what people say or what people think. You'd be surprised how people are just looking for something, too. We have a young lady who sings at St. Therese, who is Jewish, and whose husband is a rabbi. She's an opera singer. We have a small traditional choir. And I went and asked her if she would come and sing for us. She's been singing for us for 3 years, and everybody loves her.
I might, let me, Vaughn doesn't know that I know about this. the lady that she's talking about lives two doors away, three doors away from her. And she is an opera singer. I had the opportunity to be in a show, a musical show with her. Excellent. So she was singing at home, and you could hear it out in the neighborhood. And so Vaughn, with her musical ear, said, So she sent her son down there to make an inquiry. And she took that plunge. Mm-hmm. And this is a woman who loves. And she lives like a block, two blocks from the church. But she got an invitation.
Sure.
So, there's an element of risk-taking involved.
Absolutely. We need to put a comma to this conversation. We're not going to put a period to it or even a semicolon, I think, because there's a lot more that a conversation that needs to happen. I think it can go on, and we can do that. Hopefully, why don't you grab some tables at lunch and continue telling stories with each other. I do think that the one thing I would like to just say at the end here is that it seems to me that those of us who are in the United States, Guillermo, I think maybe you see this a little bit, I don't know, we sometimes think about this incredible nation that we've got where people have come from all over the globe and are all different colors. We've thought about that as a problem, as a set of hurdles to overcome. In some way, we've got to get our heads reversed, it seems to me, and begin thinking about that the way the rest of the globe thinks about that, which is an incredible set of opportunities, an incredible richness. I mean, if you talk to people in other countries, particularly in the Southern Hemisphere, what they find most interesting about the United States is our diversity, is the many colors of our rainbow. That's not a problem. That's an incredible set of assets and opportunities. And we've got to begin sort of reminding ourselves of that, it seems to me, and going forth and showing that in our church life as well. So with that, let's draw a comma on this and continue the conversation in an informal way.
Can I make one comment about the rainbow? Mm-hmm. A rainbow is a strength. A rainbow melts together.
That's right. There's overlap. There's overlap.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I was pleased to see this young fellow in the group of singers. And,
yes.
You know, a lot of young people don't have time to take part.
Yeah.
You
know?
It's a matter of wanting to. White people don't have to learn about the black community to survive. The black community has to learn about the white community to survive.
Okay. You also have a good voice, John.
Yeah.
Thank you all.
Yeah.